You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 22nd of October 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Andrew Muller. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, the United States and Japan cancel a planned joint military exercise which might have prompted consternation in Beijing. We will wade into the perennially choppy waters of the South China Sea. Turkey, ever keen to promote itself as a stable, sensible, secular republic, is, according to a new report, actually one of the world's worst abusers of press freedom. We'll find out how Turkey has managed to lock up more journalists than China.
There is a lot of protection of state in Turkey that many lawmakers are trying to change with the new constitution. And until that happens, I'm afraid we're going to see a lot of persecution of journalists.
We'll be crossing over to New York to speak to our New York bureau chief ahead of tonight's foreign policy showdown between Barack Obama and Mitt Romney. After a turbulent weekend following the assassination of Lebanon's intelligence chief, we'll have the latest from our Beirut correspondent.
It's depressing because you hear a lot of people saying, that's it, this is the one drop that it's too much. People want to leave. People do not want to stay in a depressed country.
As the Vatican hangs halos on seven new saints, we'll ask what this mass canonization says about a church recently besieged by scandal and perpetually beleaguered by reason. And we'll ask why what would appear to be one of the best jobs in European art remains infuriatingly unfulfilled. All that and some music as well coming up in the next hour here on Midori House. But before all that, the news headlines with Bill Bingham.
Monocle 24 News. Lebanon's army is urging its political leaders to show caution when expressing their opinions in a bid to calm unprecedented tensions. The call comes after clashes broke out in several areas following the killing of the senior intelligence official Wissam al-Hassan last Friday. The worst clashes were in Tripoli, in the north, where at least three people died as gunmen exchanged fire. Soldiers have been deployed in the capital, Beirut, where there have been sporadic clashes. Security staff have stopped a man carrying a knife from attacking the Finnish Prime Minister. Officials say guards prevented him from reaching Jyri Katainen as he was campaigning for next Sunday's local elections in the southwestern city of Turku. The 41-year-old Premier was unhurt and later continued meeting voters. The former teacher's Conservative National Coalition Party emerged as the largest group in elections in early 2011. Israeli forces have killed two Palestinian militants during an incursion in the northern Gaza Strip that triggered clashes with gunmen from the governing Hamas administration. Hamas officials say militants fired mortar bombs at Israeli troops spotted inside Gaza's boundary fence, which then drew airstrikes against a Hamas training camp and other targets. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, at a conference in Jerusalem, said that the Israeli actions were justified.
You know, we have rockets. We've got Hamas, supported by Iran, firing rockets at us. They fired again. We're not going to let anyone arm themselves and fire rockets on us and think that they can do this with impunity. They're not going to get away with it.
Lance Armstrong has been stripped of his 7 Tour de France titles and banned for life. The International Cycling Union, the UCI, has ratified the United States Anti-Doping Agency's sanctions against the American. UCI President Pat McQuaid says Lance Armstrong has no place in cycling and the sport now has to start again.
This is a landmark day for cycling. Cycling indeed has endured a lot of pain as it has absorbed the impact of the USADA report. UCI promised to prioritise our analysis of the report and to provide an early response, and we've done that. My message to cycling, to our riders, to our sponsors, and to our fans today is cycling has a future.
Six Italian scientists and an ex-government official have been sentenced to 6 years in prison over the 2009 earthquake in L'Aquila. They've been found guilty of multiple manslaughter. Prosecutors say the defendants gave a falsely reassuring statement before the quake. The 6.3 magnitude earth tremor devastated the city and killed 309 people. Three people have been killed in clashes between Muslims and Buddhists in western Burma. It's reported 300 houses in a number of villages have been burnt down in the state of Rakhine. It's the first serious violence since June, when a state of emergency was declared in the state after clashes between the two communities, although tensions have remained high. Libyans have been staging anti-war protests in the capital Tripoli and the country's second largest city, Benghazi, against a possible new round of civil war. Last month's attack on the US consulate in Benghazi underlined the fragility of a state struggling to emerge from the legacy of Gaddafi's 42-year rule. On this anniversary of the end of the recent civil war, Libyans are realizing they haven't yet achieved the peace they wanted.
Our first anniversary of the liberation from the Gaddafi troops, but actually we are very sad because the civil war has started. Actually, it has started. It will burn the whole of Libya.
South Korean police have blocked motorway exits near its border with North Korea to prevent activists from releasing hundreds of balloons carrying propaganda letters into communist North Korea. The country had threatened military reprisals and this time specified the time and the place of its retaliation. Technically, North and South Korea are still at war after their conflict in 1950 to 1953, and tensions run high at the border. And that's the latest Monocle 24 news.
Thanks, Bill. It's coming up for 7 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Desde Londres, esto es Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
Ut London, tu vas à Monocle 24.
De Londres, vous écoutez Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
From London,
London から.
From London,
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Desde Londres, esto es Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
From London,
this is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House live from Studio One in London. The perpetual geostrategic shadow play set in the South China Seas is so infernally complex and finely balanced that even things that aren't going to happen are freighted with enormous significance. Japan and the United States have called off a joint naval exercise scheduled for next month, apparently, not that Washington or Tokyo would admit as much, to avoid upsetting China. The exercise had been intended to simulate the recapture of an island not altogether unlike one of the Diu, or Senkaku, depending on who you're asking, islands, an agglomeration of uninhabited rock piles controlled by Japan but coveted by China, and indeed Taiwan, though that is a whole other thing. It was to have taken place on and around Irasuna Island in Okinawa Prefecture, and now it isn't. And joining me now to explain why they've called the whole thing off is Dr. Alessio Patalano, lecturer in war studies at King's College University. Alessio, first of all, tell us why a bunch of islands that nobody lives on are such a sensitive subject.
Good evening, Andrew. Yes, well, you know, there is an element that is unique to these islands. These islands speak straight to the very heart of one of the core features provided by state actors, by government, and that is the protection of sovereign interest and the protection of sovereignty, territorial integrity. So even though these islands are not necessarily of particular intrinsic value in themselves, provided they're very small, and you know they can't really sustain permanent human life in them, they certainly do have a very important political value for this reason.
I mean, had this exercise gone ahead, and this is kind of a question in two parts, how upset would China actually have been, and how upset would China have pretended to be?
Well, I think you're absolutely right in breaking the question in two. And if you want, even before answering this, there is a very an even more fundamental question: is it really true that this thing, this exercise has been called off just because they didn't want to upset China? I think that is an important point to take in mind, provided that just ahead of this announcement, one of the two Marines that were allegedly accused of rape with an Okinawan citizen admitted actually that had been the case in this sort of context. So I think there is an element when we talk about these particular exercises. It doesn't necessarily revolve around China, but in a wider sense also to the US-Japan Security Alliance and the particular sort of difficult Okinawan component into it.
I mean, also, I guess, to take that thought another step further, and again, as you're well aware, once you start pulling on one string where the South China Sea is concerned, things can unravel rapidly. Is there any chance at all that this exercise was basically scheduled in order to be cancelled, i.e. that US and Japan never really had any intention of doing it, but have done this in order to look like they've made like a placatory gesture to China?
There is no evidence nor indication that that would be the case, because this exercise is part of a series of exercises that are regularly scheduled throughout the year, and they are part of the military cooperation between Japan and the United States under the U.S.-Japan Security Alliance. In particular, there's always a naval exercise scheduled during this final quarter of the year. Now, I think it is very wise in the end that the exercises were supposed to take place during political transition and when the political handover in China was happening. Perhaps the fact that they decided for the moment not to have it taking place was a wise move after all, to avoid actually something that, regardless of whether it actually had something to do with China or not, could have been used for political purposes during the sort of political transition in China. That said, I think we should probably have to wait for a little longer and try to see whether they will reschedule this type of exercise later on before the end of the year.
You mentioned there the other possible reason for these exercises being called off, which is the recent arrest of two American servicemen on charges of rape on Okinawa.
Yes.
How fragile is that relationship? How popular or otherwise is the United States presence on Okinawa?
You know, this is a very difficult component of the entire equation, in a sense that for many years now, we know there's been a renegotiation process and to try to relocate part of the American presence in Okinawa, which is by far in terms of ratio, number of local population and territory occupied, it is the one part of Japan with the highest concentration of American troops. And so for many years, it's always been one of the critical components, both in the domestic arena, insofar as Japanese politics are concerned. So Okinawa has always felt that this problem had to be addressed, and more of the entire Japanese population should share the burden of the bases. But at the same time, it's also a problem in terms of the actual presence of foreign troops in Okinawa, and sometimes the fact that their behavior got out of hand and brought about this very sorry situation.
Back in the United States, there is, of course, the final presidential debate tonight, which will allegedly at least focus on foreign policy. Given that Mitt Romney has made such a motif of claiming that he wouldn't, as president, kowtow to China, do you think Obama's likely to get clobbered with this one later on?
Well, it depends very much on how the debate is going to evolve. I think that, as I say, this could possibly be one of the ways in which in the debate it might actually come about, but it would be a very sort of risky choice, because as I say, it is not just about the question of China, but it might actually bring about questions or raise questions about American presence in Okinawa, American bases in Japan, and that definitely would be a tricky territory even for the Republican candidate. So I think they have to be very careful on how they use this type of news, especially because at the moment we have no official sort of confirmation beyond the GG press release.
The South China Sea, of course, as I said in the introduction, is an arena in which an awful lot of diplomatic and military posturing and chest puffing does take place. But aside from all that, how genuinely volatile and dangerous is it? How significant is the chance of meaningful armed conflict in the region?
I think, you know, more than armed conflict, what we're looking at is a serious risk insofar as all the law enforcement agencies operating in these, both in the East and the South China Sea, are concerned. That is probably one of the areas that is very difficult, because when we're talking about these contested waters as well as contested offshore islands, whether it is in the East or the South China Sea, most of the forces that are deployed to make a point about the contested nature of these waters and islands are primarily law enforcement agencies. And while in Japan, pretty much you've got either the fishery agency and the Japanese Coast Guard who are primarily involved into the enforcement of Japanese sort of administrative controls in the East China Sea, insofar as China is concerned, that both in the South and the East China Sea, there's more, there's at least five organizations, including the China Maritime Surveillance and FLEC, which is the equivalent of a sort of fishery patrol agency. Now, these agencies, while they can be well coordinated, they just operating very close to each other. So even an unintended accident or the drowning of some people, we don't necessarily know how far they can prompt a further escalation. But at the moment, what is certain is that war in a sort of like a armed conflict seems far off, provided that the main military components of all the actors involved are staying well off the sort of line of conduct.
Alessio Patilano, lecturer in war studies at King's College University, thank you as ever for joining us. You're listening to Midori House.
The November issue of Monocle takes the pulse of the world as we investigate how good healthcare makes a nation. We reveal who has the best nurses, meet a mayor who put his city on a diet, and visit a hospital the size of a city. And there's lots more to make you feel better about the world too.
In the business section, we find out about the healthy Japanese tipple that represents a $1.2 billion industry. We take to the skies with the CEO of Australia's Royal Flying Doctor Service, and our Washington correspondent profiles the small businesses making a healthy profit on the US presidential campaign trail.
In the affairs section, we go on the road with an elderly band of diplomats. I sit down with Malaysia's Mr. Fixit, and we also present our 10-point plan for the next US president, whoever that may be.
In the design section, we tackle grey matters, looking at three pioneering projects designed for the elderly around the world. We also create our own perfect community in which to grow old. Elsewhere, we drop in on a beautiful new cancer treatment centre by Nord Architects in Copenhagen that's more like a home than a hospital.
The November issue of Monocle also includes a special expo that limbers up with Japanese companies as they bend knees and reach for better profits with the aid of morning exercise routines. It's all on newsstands now and also available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Midori House. Turkey is fond of selling itself as a bridge between Europe and the Middle East, politically and spiritually, as well as geographically. Turkey positions itself to the west as a bastion of relative stability and sanity in a volatile region, and to the rest of the Middle East as an example of a moderate, modern Islamic nation. The last few weeks have not been good for this assiduously cultivated image of reasonableness. Days after Turkey put one of its most distinguished artists, pianist Fazıl Say, on trial for teasing God on Twitter, a new report by the Committee to Protect Journalists has cited Turkey as one of the worst abusers of press in the world. In recent years, according to the report, Turkey has locked up more journalists than Iran, Eritrea, or even China. Earlier, I spoke to Sebnem Asu, Istanbul correspondent for the New York Times. I began by asking her if the CPJ's report was likely to appear in any Turkish newspapers.
I wouldn't expect a large coverage. It will maybe appear in a small corner in the mainstream newspapers, but surely it's going to attract lots of attention in abroad, many people hope and think. And those people happen to be mostly democracy advocates, human rights advocates that have been campaigning for better freedom of expression in Turkey for very long now. The current situation looks not very promising, we're afraid. There are many journalists who are in jail, and the government constantly denies these numbers and say that the people who are in jail are not in jail because of journalistic activities. So the problem there is the government does not recognize journalists who do not hold what we call press cards as recognized journalists. And there are a lot of reporters, there are a lot of people working in the media who do not enjoy the benefits of this press card or listed as journalists in the official papers, but do perform journalistic activities.
For the people who do work as journalists in Turkey, how arbitrary or otherwise are the rules? Does everybody know where the lines are that they can't cross, or can you get arrested for just about anything?
Well, the thing is, the line is pretty much stretching here and there. You can't really tell. Of course, there are thorny issues like the PKK, the Kurdish rebels or militants, or what the Turkish government call as terrorists. So anything that has to do with Kurdish conflict is an edgy issue. Or when you talk about issues of religion, that turns out to be another thorny issue these days. I mean, we've seen one of the internationally acclaimed pianists in Turkey, named Fazıl Say, being charged on inciting religious hatred because of what he said about religion in his Twitter account. So the issues journalists know that are thorny are there. But we see in the recent persecutions in the last 2-3 years that no matter what you say, as long as the government agencies or the persecutors define it as something not in line with the interests of the state, you end up in court. I can't really say these are the issues. It's pretty much up in the air. For example, there were two journalists, Ahmet Çık and Nedim Şener, who've been in jail over a year without even knowing what they've been charged with. So there is a lot of protection of state in Turkey that many lawmakers are trying to change with the new constitution. And until that happens, I'm afraid we're going to see a lot of persecution of journalists.
Is the Turkish government likely to be at all embarrassed by this report? Turkey is, of course, always at pains to present itself as a secular, Western-looking, modern nation. At least that's how it's keen to present itself outside Turkey. How troubled will they be by the idea that they might acquire a reputation for being an oppressor of press freedom?
I don't think there is going to be a lot of embarrassment on the part of the Turkish government, because I see that pretty much aligns with the government's interest in joining the EU. Unfortunately, we do not hear the talk of EU in the government circles as much as we've heard it in previous years. For example, there was the governing party Congress last month. And not even once the Prime Minister made a note of European Union objective in his speech, which is quite worrying, because before it was the Turkey's human rights record came to fore, was discussed as part of Turkey's eagerness to join the EU, because we're talking about legislative standards, a pact of universal morals that Turkey wanted to align itself with.
Is there much popular anger within Turkey about this? I mean, I know journalists aren't the characters in the world who attract the most popular sympathy, but are many Turkish people angry about this, or do they simply not know what's going on?
Well, the government has huge popularity in the eyes of the majority of Turkish people. People who pay attention to these things happen to be from the circles who are more critical of the government policies. So, of course, this doesn't mean that Turkish people have lost their common sense, have lost their, general understanding of human rights and liberties. No. But unfortunately, we see that coming up when a truly welcomed or embraced figures in the media being charged by the persecutors, as we've seen in the case of Nedim Şener, Ahmet Çık. I mean, those two people were so fostered in the minds and eyes of so many people that the charges posed against them were considered to be absolutely outrageous, that we saw this huge campaign for their release. And in the end, they got released, but we have around 661, according to the latest count of international organizations, journalists sitting in jail or, you know, standing on trial. The reason why there is not the same public support behind them is because most of these people, I do not know the actual countdown, but my guess is that the number of the pro-Kurdish journalists who face charges is just too many. And because they come from smaller publications, they do not, they basically pass unheard.
And that was Sebnem Arsu, the New York Times correspondent in Istanbul, talking to me a little earlier. You're listening to Midori House. And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24, live from London. It's 18:25 here in London, which means it's 13:25 here in... Is that right? 18 minus 5? That's right, isn't it? 13:25 in New York. And that's where we're heading right now to speak to Monocle's bureau chief, Aisha Spears. Welcome again to Midori House, Aisha. Have you been out buying popcorn ahead of tonight's debate yet?
I haven't yet. I'm going to get my snacks on the way home from the office, I think. But it's definitely, I'm going to be camped on my couch watching the final presidential debate this evening.
What's more important here? Is it the substance of the debate or the perception of who has won it? Because the conventional wisdom is that, especially in America, that foreign policy has almost no bearing on the outcomes of elections.
Exactly. I think it's certainly the latter. I think it's a case of who comes out strongest in this debate. The first debate between Romney and Obama, Romney clearly came out more strong. Second debate, Obama got the lead. So it'll be interesting to see who does come forward on this one. I think it's going to be easy for Romney to attack Obama because Obama's actually been the president for the last 4 years. So he has certain policies that he can actually go for when arguing with him. But Romney also has no foreign policy experience. So we'll see who comes out better in this one.
And of course, the only foreign policy experience Romney does have was his less than stellar jaunt overseas earlier this year, which became known as the Romney Shambles Expedition.
Indeed, and it's certainly not a good thing to have that much foreign press criticizing him, so that's not a good look. There was a mention at the town hall debate last week of the consulate attack in Benghazi, which Romney didn't particularly look very good on. It was part of his kind of petty attack at Obama. He got some facts wrong. So far, his track record in talking about foreign policy in the presidential debates hasn't been too strong. But they're kind of, Obama's got a little lead in the polls. Florida doesn't look like it may just go to Romney, and this debate is taking place in Florida, so it's going to be an interesting night. It definitely is the last time we're going to see the two of them arguing before they kind of knuckle down and get hard on the campaign trail before the election.
And we do know, keeping it in New York, that Barack Obama does at least have the New Yorker on his side. The New Yorker has endorsed him in a resounding editorial. Granted, it would have been an incomprehensible surprise had the New Yorker endorsed Romney, but will this actually make any difference to Obama?
I don't think so. Exactly as you say, I think it would have been incredibly shocking if the New Yorker had gone anywhere near endorsing Romney. The cover of the issue that comes out today, which has this Talk of the Town piece written by the editors which endorses Obama, the cover has a picture of Mitt Romney with a series of tattoos on certain policies all being scratched out, so hinting towards the idea that he flip-flops and doesn't really know what he's doing and doesn't make clear promises. And that's one of the criticisms that's coming over from the DNC this morning, saying about ahead of tonight's debate, it's going to be hard to know what Romney will say because Romney actually has never really expressed clear foreign policy ideas.
Well, there is a conflict raging near where you are, I believe, in Brooklyn. This has already become known as the chicken coop wars. Can you please explain what's at stake here and who the combatants are?
It's one of those rather keeping up with the Joneses pathetic stories that does kind of catch local news every so often. So there is a chicken coop war in Park Slope in Brooklyn, which is a very yummy mummy pushchair kind of neighborhood. Lots of big brownstones and good looking 30-somethings who move out from the city to to procreate in Park Slope. So you've got a lot of people who have decided to go there and keep quiet families, and there's the Warren St. Mark's Community Garden in Park Slope has now, for the last 10 days, had some chickens in there. I think it's 8 chickens, and there's a lot of complaint from residents saying that the chickens are clucking too loud, that they might encourage rats. Some are even saying that avian flu could be a threat, and apparently the debates got quite heated. The chickens normally live on Governor's Island, but have been moved to Park Slope for the winter. So it's a funny little debate, I think, that's going on this evening, probably in Park Slope, for people who won't be watching Romney and Obama duke it out.
It would come as a considerable surprise if it was mentioned in the debate. But how is it likely to be resolved? Are the people of Park Slope stuck with the chickens for the winter?
They might be, because I think that the park itself is actually on private land, so they can't really decide what to do. The whole point is this is a community garden, so they're saying, as part of the community, we should talk about this. We're not happy with this. And then some people are saying, well, what about the poor chickens? It's the kind of thing which I can imagine all sorts of residents wasting months of the winter over, and by the time they've resolved it, the chickens will move back to Governor's Island anyway.
Well, I for one hope we can come back to that, because there's no end of brilliant chicken puns we could write in the introductions for stories about that. Monocle's New York Bureau Chief Aisha Spears, thank you as ever for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. In the next half hour of the programme, we will have the latest from another tumultuous weekend in Beirut. But first, here's Bill Bingham with the news headlines.
Lebanon's army is urging its political leaders to show caution when expressing their opinions in a bid to calm unprecedented tensions. The call comes after clashes broke out in several areas following the killing of the senior intelligence official Wissam al-Hassan last Friday. The worst clashes were in Tripoli in the north, where at least 3 people died as gunmen exchanged fire. The head of Belgium's Royal Cycling League has welcomed the International Cycling Federation's decision to strip cyclist Lance Armstrong of his 7 Tour de France titles. Tom Van Dam has called it a logical decision and the only possible action the UCI could take following the report into Lance Armstrong's activities by the US anti-doping agency USADA. 6 Italian scientists and an ex-government official have been sentenced to 6 years in prison over the 2009 earthquake in L'Aquila. They've been found guilty of multiple manslaughter. Prosecutors say the defendants gave a falsely reassuring statement before the quake. Security staff have stopped a man carrying a knife from attacking the Finnish Prime Minister. Officials say guards prevented him from reaching Jyri Katainen as he was campaigning for next Sunday's local elections in the southwestern city of Turku. The 41-year-old premier was unhurt and later continued meeting voters. Israeli forces have killed 2 Palestinian militants during an incursion in the northern Gaza Strip that triggered clashes with gunmen from the governing Hamas administration. Hamas officials say militants fired mortar bombs at Israeli troops spotted inside Gaza's boundary fence, which then drew airstrikes against a Hamas training camp and other targets. France is supporting a backdated recapitalisation of Ireland's banks. President Francois Hollande has held talks with the Irish Prime Minister Enda Kenny and told him Ireland's banking sector should be treated as a special case. Lawyers for the 2 convicted women from the Russian punk band Pussy Riot say they're on their way to 2 prison camps a long way from home. Maria Alyokhina and Nadezhda Tolokonikova were jailed for 2 years each in August for singing an anti-Kremlin song in a cathedral. And that's the latest Monocle 24 news at the bottom of the hour.
Thanks, Bill. You're listening to Midori House, and therefore it seems appropriate to play a track from one of our Midori House sessions when our favourite artists come and play here live. This was a particular favourite of mine recorded earlier this year. This is the very great Todd Snyder with Looking for a Job.
You can't talk to me like that, boy. I don't care who you are. If you don't wanna have to hang your own drywall, don't push me too far. Boomtown work ain't job when I met you.
The fabulous Todd Snyder with Looking for a Job, recorded live here at Midori House. After the assassination of intelligence chief Wissam al-Hassan last Friday, Lebanon is a nation once again on the edge of violence. The assassination of al-Hassan, a Sunni Muslim, provoked anti-government protests in Beirut and gun battles between Shia and Sunni factions in Tripoli, focusing fears that the crisis in Syria is finally about to suck Lebanon in. To explore the implications of the latest developments, our editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé sat down a little earlier with our Beirut correspondent Carol Corm.
I don't think there will be a civil war, although everyone is jumping to conclusions on the news. I mean, immediately this is civil war, Sunni against Shia, a Syrian conflict spreading into Lebanon. I do not think so. I think this is just the latest assassination, the latest brutal act by another power in Lebanon. But I do not think that this will spread. Saad Hariri and Senyora, all the Sunni leaders yesterday, were saying, well, calming down the Sunni street that were protesting in front of the Sarai. Mi'ati maybe intelligently left today, remembered it was Hajj and left for Saudi Arabia because people are asking for his resignation. So things are going to calm down. Businesses were open today. True, I'm sure there's not many people in restaurants. No one's partying for a week. It's going to be very calm. People are afraid, of course, because this was the head of intelligence. If they can get him, they can get anyone. But this is not a civil war, like a lot of media outlets are jumping to conclusions. The scene of bombs and blood, but people covered with blood. This is what people think immediately, but this is not the scenario.
Mm. Do you think it's in everyone's interests right now? I mean, even if we go to the south of the city as well, that people really want to keep this contained, and partly because of the momentum, you know, despite everything that's been happening in Syria. I think everyone has been surprised. Of course, the summertime is an incredibly important period. Hotel bookings were maybe not what they were for the past few summers, but I think everyone was quite pleased to see the fact that it has not sort of spilled over in quite the way that people might have predicted.
I mean, people are on edge and nothing is really happening because it's this wait and see, which is quite terrible for the economy. We're waiting to see what's going to happen in Syria and the conflict's dragging. Now, in a week, it's Eid al-Adha. It's another big Muslim celebration. We were kind of hoping the Khalijis, the Gulfi people, were going to come. They're not going to come anymore. So the economy is in shatters, but there is a status quo. The leaders do not want conflict spreading in Lebanon, and I don't think it will happen.
Mm. I mean, are you surprised that so far things have managed to have been as contained as they have been, that we haven't seen these types of incidents? And of course, you know, anytime, you know, a car bomb of this scale, and as you say, you know, the fact that they can get to the intelligence chief means that probably no one is safe. But, you know, as a resident, if you look back over the last few months, at least as someone who's traveled out there enough, I'm surprised anyway that it's remained as calm as it has in Beirut.
I am, and I think we're lucky. I think the Miati government, that everyone is attacking him because he's tried to disassociate his government from what's happening in Syria. It's very hard. Our borders are, everything comes in through Syria. We're totally linked to Syria. So in a way, it's good that nothing has happened until now. This incident is just a bit frightening because you see the reach of these forces that can really attack in the heart of tolerant, glitzy Beirut, and that's what's frightening.
Mm. Any surprise that it happened in Christian Ashrafieh as opposed to somewhere else, or was this just a pure opportunity?
I think it was a pure opportunity because there's a March 14th bureau, which I went into for a Monocle story a couple years ago, that's where he was going. There was a meeting at 3:30 and they attacked him just before. But until we heard that the bomb was targeted against Wissam al-Hassan, everyone was very scared because it was like, this is a totally blind attack at school hour. Kids were going out of school. This is one of the biggest squares in the Christian neighborhood of Beirut. Starbucks, the biggest mall in town, is there. And that was very frightening.
Mm.
It's not, you know, the end of the confines of the country on the border with Syria. No, it really was. This is the window that we show to foreigners. This is where well-to-do Lebanese go and show the world how tolerant and Europeanized and modern they are.
Mm. I mean, as you said, Miati is obviously heading to Saudi, and we haven't, at least there hasn't been that much in terms of seeing Maronite spokesmen and people from the Christian community coming forward. But But aside from surprise, I mean, what have you been seeing in the Lebanese press, and or at least what have you been hearing when you're speaking to friends and colleagues?
I think there was a huge shock. I mean, even myself on Friday, very depressed. It's just this another like knock in the face. Every time we try to get up and try not to meddle in politics, we're, let's say, our neighbors do not let the Lebanese breathe. We're not allowed to breathe. We're not allowed to breathe freedom. Every time we try something, to, you know, have a good summer, have a good Eid, well, someone brings us back. And then, I mean, these stories, you know, that we've heard some politicians are being threatened. They received SMSs after this thing saying, you're the next one, that kind of thing. I mean, it's like a science fiction or a police novel. And this is our reality. The Lebanese are just really tired, and they're tired of the politicians. They just want this to go away. They want to be Switzerland. They want to be Austria. They want to be neutral. But unfortunately, we're not heading that way.
And you talk about sort of moving things forward. We've seen the summer season. The Christmas period is also incredibly important economically for the country as well, no?
Well, take me, for instance. I'm publishing my guide on Beirut, which is at the printing press right now. I'm doing the invites, and then I hear there's a bomb. No one is coming. Who wants to promote a guide, a touristic guide on Beirut, when you have the head of intelligence that's assassinated in one of the popular, supposedly safe havens of the city? Okay, I'm one example. Then there's restaurants, there's hotels. And this is our economy, right? Tourism. Yeah. So it's not looking good.
Yeah, and as we know, oftentimes the Lebanese, for perhaps all of the right reasons, you know, have one foot in and one foot out of the country. Would you say most people have more weight on the foot outside of the country at the moment?
It's depressing because you hear a lot of people saying, that's it, this is the one drop that it's too much, we want to leave, people want to leave, people do not want to stay in a depressed country. But that said, I mean, Lebanon will always be Lebanon, will always be the playground. We need Lebanon in the Middle East. Lebanese will bounce back in a week's time. Everyone will have moved on, because we don't have another choice, sure, but we will have moved on. We're very resilient, and hopefully, I mean, there'll be exhibition openings, there'll be new restaurants, new hotels. Life's going to continue.
And that was our Beirut correspondent, Carole Corme, talking to our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. You're listening to Midori House. We will be back to profile seven new saints. Stay with us.
Section D is Monocle 24's show about design. Each week we take you on a whistle-stop tour of the people and places making a splash in the world of craft, architecture, graphics, fashion and retail.
How do you explain the value of design? What can we do to make clients and designers work better together?
On the latest episode, we head to Istanbul's inaugural design biennial. We poke around Lisbon's first open house weekend. And we go shopping with Shanghai gallerist Pearl Lam at the Pavilion of Art and Design in London.
Industrial design has been really important when we look at the Bauhaus, starting from Bauhaus time, because each of the design, each of the technology represent a certain time in history, reflecting economic, political and social.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24. Join us at 2200 hours London time and end the day with the Monocle Daily, live every weekday.
It's 1844 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Kateri Tekakwitha, Pedro Calungsod, Jacques Berthiaud, Giovanni Piamata, Carmen Sayers Ibarrageras, Maria Anna Cope and Anna Schaffer were admitted yesterday to an ancient and exclusive club, named by Pope Benedict XVI as the seven newest additions to the Catholic Church's pantheon of saints. Five of the seven were best known for missionary work, suggesting a renewed determination on the part of the scandal battered church to gather new lambs into its flock. Well, joining me now is Robert Mickens. He's the Rome correspondent for The Tablet. Robert, is it common to canonize seven saints in one go?
Well, in the past, Pope John Paul II, of course, canonized lots of people, and many of these canonization ceremonies were done a number of people at the same time. So there's nothing particularly strange about that. However, you did mention that five of these new saints were missionaries, and it was no coincidence that the Pope chose to canonize them yesterday, this past Sunday, on what the Church around the world celebrated as World Mission Sunday.
Okay, so does this signal a renewed determination, I guess, by Pope Benedict XVI that the Catholic Church should become more activist, if you like, that it should be less coy about spreading its word than it might have been the last decade or so?
There's no question about that. I mean, the Catholic Church, certainly the Christian Church, but certainly Catholics, have always seen the core kind of constitution of this body of believers as being evangelizing or missionary by its very nature. And that's been stressed over and over again. And at the Second Vatican Council, there was a rediscovery and a reemphasis put on the evangelizing or missionary nature of Christian faith. But also, this year, as we mark the 50th anniversary of the beginning of the Second Vatican Council, Pope Benedict has just inaugurated, just last week, the 11th of October, an entire, what he called, Year of Faith. And that's within the context of a new evangelization that Pope John Paul II first called for about 30 years ago, in which Benedict XVI is trying to relaunch in this Year of Faith, beginning with, first of all, a new Vatican office that he set up last year for the new evangelization, and a meeting of the Synod of Bishops, which is currently underway here in Rome, which is taken as its focus, the new evangelization for the transmission of the Christian faith. So it's all part of a piece, but it's nothing new. It's just trying to revitalize something that's at the very core of and nature of being Christian.
Within that context, how much of a public relations spin, I guess, or public relations consideration is there in the canonizing of new saints? Among this seven, there's the second Filipino saint and the first ever Native American saint. Is the process entirely pure-hearted, or is it done with an eye on how and with whom it's going to play?
Well, certainly one of the great things, I think, great features of Catholic Christianity, and I would say probably all Christian churches, but certainly the Catholic Church puts a great emphasis on signs and symbols, sacraments, these exterior signs of the interior reality of what the Church is all about. And really, when the Church as a community, in the person of the Pope, who does this with his own authority, canonizes somebody, that new saint is meant to be a model or an inspiration of Christian life for run-of-the-mill, everyday believers. And so, certainly without a doubt, these are very colorful ceremonies. These are people who live extraordinary lives, ordinary people who live extraordinary lives. And I can just tell you that at St. Peter's Square yesterday, some 80,000 people who filled the square, many of them were wearing Native American dress. A lot of the Filipinos had very clearly Filipino folk costumes. There were Germans in lederhosen and dirndls. So you got a sense of the kind of inculturation of faith, but also the different parts of the world where Christianity is spread. And this is meant to be, I think, ideally in the mind of the Pope and the bishops, an inspiration for people to live their faith with more intensity.
And how intense is the lobbying on behalf of the prospective saints from the communities they come from? Because all other considerations aside, there's presumably a huge economic aspect to having a saint come from the place you come from.
Well, certainly just by means of the work that it takes, the documentation that must be gathered, the people that must be employed to look at the lives of these figures, to conduct interviews, inquiries, to print up this stuff, this takes a long time. Blessed Kateri, who became saint yesterday, was declared a saint yesterday. Her cause was begun about 100 years ago or more. So yes, this is certainly, religious orders often have the advantage of having members that they can dedicate specifically to pursuing the documentation needed to push a cause. Basically what it is you have to make a case. You have to make a case that these people lived heroic lives, lives of Christian virtue. And then in order to be a blessed, one must have proof that, pretty sure proof that this person interceded on behalf of someone to work a miracle, and the second miracle needed for sainthood. So this takes an awful lot of work. Like takes time, and time takes money. So in that sense, yes, it's a laborious and not inexpensive process.
Robert Mickens, Rome correspondent for The Tablet, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. This is Cock and Bull Kid with The Hoarder. Was Cock and Bull Kid with The Hoarder. And you're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Given Spain's wheezing economy and rampaging unemployment, Madrid streets have hosted plenty of tumult of late. One place that has remained a mostly serene refuge from the ructions is the Museo del Prado, Spain's foremost national museum and home of one of the world's finest collections of European art. But the works by Titian, Rubens, Velázquez and Goya lining the halls disguise some serious trouble. At the top. Not only is the Prado beset by Spain's austerity drive, but this great institution is currently rudderless. The museum has been without a president, as its funding has been cut and its tickets prices increased. The absence of a suitable leader is now causing a national outrage. And to find out more, we have our Madrid correspondent, Liam Algis. Liam, how long has the Prado been without a president?
Well, it's actually been without a president since May, and it's not surprising given the massive funding cuts the institution has undergone in the last, well, since the economic crisis began. In 2009, it was receiving about 27.5 million euros in government support, and that was reduced to 24 million in 2010, and then it's been a downward scale since then. And now, with the massive cuts coming up to a possible European bailout, it's only receiving about 11.5 million euros from the government, which is a huge, huge cut.
So is it the case that nobody actually wants the job? I mean, cuts and austerity notwithstanding, that would still be a not impressive entry on your CV.
Well, exactly. I think it's two things. It's one, it's one of those cases where no one really wants to board a sinking ship. Not that it's really a sinking ship, but it's quite a difficult post to have, especially because without the funding, the Prado itself can't actually get those massive exhibitions and acquire a great artwork, so they don't have the funding power. So that's one of the factors. The other factor would be that the government is just floundering in their selection process. The government, the culture minister, obviously has to name the president, and there's quite a few candidates in the mix. Some crazy names have been thrown around, one of them being the ex-president Aznar, but that's been scrapped because it's quite outrageous, especially because he wants to, his dream job is to become the president of Real Madrid, not the president of the Prado. But some of the candidates are quite interesting, but the question is whether the culture minister will choose someone based on merit or someone based on their political ties.
But in amid everything else that Spaniards currently have to be outraged about, how much outrage is there about this?
Well, it depends who you talk to. Obviously, in artistic circles, there's quite a lot of outrage. The decision itself is meant to be announced this Thursday, and there's been a lot of comparisons made to the selection of the new pope, whether the black smoke will arise from the Casa Villanueva or white smoke will arise. But either way, there's not much faith that the culture minister, who is quite controversial because he also has the education ministry, and it's just basically his job is to announce cuts and say scandalous things. He's got quite a mouth on him as well. So not much faith is being placed in his decision. And the candidate that may actually get the job is actually a constitutional lawyer, and hasn't got much affiliation in the art world, but he is Moncloa, which is the Spain's equivalent to the White House. Moncloa's best bet for the job. So his name is José Pedro Pérez Llorca, and they're saying that he probably will get the job. But there's other people like Carlos Zurita, who's the Duke of Soria. He's actually a current president of the Friends of the Prado Museum. He's on the board as well. He's also the king's brother-in-law, which is actually quite a good connection to have when you're being considered for the job.
It couldn't hurt, you would think.
Yeah, well, it's also because the Prado is the royal family's art collection. So obviously, that's a good connection to have when you're being considered for this job. But I mean, it should really be based on merit, the decision. So, like I said, there's not much faith being placed in the decision making process.
And has anyone in Spain yet got to the position of suggesting selling the entire collection off to try and raise a few quid?
Well, there is a fear, actually, particularly in the artistic community, that the government does actually want to privatize all the museums. And a lot of comparisons are being made to France, where France, I mean, the Louvre gets about 100 million euros from the government to support it, to support the institution, whereas the Prado, which is seen as one of the most important artistic institutions in Europe, only gets 11 million euros. So there is a great fear that this will happen. And if you see, there's been cuts across the board. The Thyssen, the Reina Sofia have all received cuts, even the National Library. Everyone's having cutbacks. So obviously culture is the first target when they need to save money, education as well, health as well. So, I mean, that is the fear at the end of the day. So, yeah, we'll see.
Liam Algis, Monocle's man in Madrid, thank you as ever for joining us. And that's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. Thanks to our producer Dawn Trump, our researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and studio manager Ben Jay. Up next after the news is this week's episode of Culture, and today our culture editor Robert Bound is busy finding out about a bizarre museum in Berlin, discovering exciting new bands at the CMJ Marathon in New York, and meeting a man who's decided to translate Homer's Iliad into South African English.
The Greek of the Iliad itself is a mixed language. It's a kind of poetic dialect created out of various Greek dialects. So to translate it by a mixed form of English is actually reasonably appropriate.
I'll be back 3 hours from now with Tamsin Smith for the Monocle Daily. Thanks for listening.